Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. On this week's podcast, Kyle Malin and Samantha Schreiber get primary election predictions from Bill Ballinger of the Ballinger Report, Republican primary analysis from John Yob of Strategic National, and thoughts from Senator Ken Horn on his new book, Letters to Heaven, his personal story about working through the grief of the loss of his two-year-old granddaughter, Zelly. Now, here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin and MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. It's the day before the primary, Samantha. And what day before the primary would be complete without some predictions?
No, I definitely think it's time to get your bets in privately, on the record, however you wish. I have the MERS prize basket in the works, so
stay tuned. Well, good. And as I was thinking about this podcast, I said, who better to bring on to talk about predictions than Bill Ballinger of the Ballinger Report? He's been doing it for years, and he's usually right on, aren't you, Bill?
Well, usually, but I'd rather have some judicial races that nobody else paid attention to, because then if I was wrong, who knew, you know?
Well, yeah, or the other thing that you could do is we could do all the races where we have, like, Tom Barrett running against the write-in in the 7th Congressional District Republican one. And we could all pick Tom Barrett, and that would just boost our average, you know, so we could do a whole bunch of gimmies. But what fun is that?
Yeah, always bet on somebody who's unopposed. You're bound to win. That gets the percentage up.
So we did pick 11 races, and the MERS team and some of our consultants this morning, but you're kind of the capper. You're the person who kind of is the cherry on top, who gives us some validity. So we're going to go through these races, and if you're listening to this podcast on Wednesday or Thursday or later in the week, you'll get to see how smart or how out of touch Bill is. No pressure or anything, Bill.
I think I'm being set up. Anyway, go ahead. I'm ready.
Let's start with
Bring it on.
We're going to start on the Republican primary for governor. Who is going to win the nomination, Bill?
Tudor Dixon.
And that's because of Donald Trump?
That really is what pushed her over the top, I think, at the end. I think she was already in the lead in the polls going into the final days. You and I talked about this on television just last week when it looked like Trump would not make an endorsement. And then all of a sudden, after he saw an advance video of our conversation, he decided, I've had enough of this. I'm getting into it. I'm endorsing. I'm going to show these guys up.
Well, you know, he probably saw it online before he actually made his endorsement at 8 o'clock at night, right? So he could have watched
exactly.
off the record at 3 or 4.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what happened. He said, I'm going to show these guys up. What do they know? I'm the Donald. I make the call when I decide to make it. And I've had enough of this.
I think something to also keep in mind of is that there are voters that thought that Donald Trump already gave Tudor Dixon his endorsement from when he had his spring rally in Washington Township, when he gave her that little shout out. Some people already confused that as an endorsement in itself.
Well, the big factor for me, and we discussed this last week, was whether he would not endorse her, even though he wanted to, simply because of her allegiance to the DeVos family and Betsy DeVos, who he views as having betrayed him by resigning from the cabinet and meeting with a group that was talking about invoking the 25th Amendment. The Donald does not like what he perceives as betrayal, disloyalty. He'll come after you if that happens. And I thought that might keep him from endorsing Tudor Dixon. I don't think he dared endorse anybody else because he was afraid, even if it was Kevin Rinke with his millions, that he was going to lose, and then the Donald would be embarrassed. He'd have another loss on his score sheet.
What did you think about Betsy DeVos's handwritten letter to former President Trump? Do you think that played a role? Because it would seem that he looked at that as kind of an apology of sorts. We're on the same team. Fake news. If we work together, we're going to both get a win. All for party unity. What kind of impact do you think that had?
You know, Kyle, what do we know? Seriously, there could be a backstory on this of which we're unaware that would explain a lot of things. But frankly, I think it was a good thing for her to do. And it might have had some impact on Trump if we could take it in a straightforward fashion. But honestly, I got to believe that there was a lot of back and forth between Betsy DeVos and the Trump operation and Tudor Dixon about this whole thing. So I don't think we're ever going to be sure exactly what happened. But the bottom line for Tudor Dixon is it seems to have worked. And she got the endorsement. And that leads some people to conclude that she is ipso facto nominated. I'm not sure it's that certain at this point, but that's who I'll call as the winner on Tuesday.
So who finishes in second?
Kevin Rinke.
Is that because of all the TV ads he's put up, the $10 million that he's spent on the air and another?
Yes.
Things?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Primarily, yes. I mean, look, he tried to position himself to a certain extent as the Rick Snyder of 2010 in this campaign, the more slightly moderate candidate out of five, which Snyder was in 2010 compared to four more conservative opponents that Snyder had 12 years ago. But I don't think that really broke through to the general population or to the electorate tomorrow, the voters, the Republicans who are going to participate in this primary. I think it was the TV ads. If he didn't have any more money than Garrett Soldano or Ryan Kelly, I don't think we'd be talking about Kevin Rinke necessarily finishing second.
I have Garrett Soldano finishing second, and the reason is because I think that the Donald endorsement hurts Rinke the most with undecided voters, and I think Soldano's got the deeper bench of supporters who are willing to support him. They're less wishy-washy, and they're going to vote for him regardless of what the Donald does. I think they're somebody who John Yob later in this podcast calls the ultra megas. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, okay, so let's say Tudor Dixon wins tomorrow night. You know, she has this new responsibility, I can anticipate. That is, how are you going to patch together all of the infighting that has essentially defined the 2022 Republican community? And, you know, I think if you're unable to patch that together, that plays to Governor Whitmer's advantage in a general election.
Yeah, I think you're right on that, Sam. But we'll see how they do with that. We're going to talk about that with John Yob in a little bit. Let's get to the next race here. Third Congressional District, Bill. Who wins here with John Gibbs and Peter Meyer?
Yeah, that is a real head-scratcher. I'm going to go with Meyer. I think he's going to pull it out. Simply, again, I think money is a factor. I mean, he spent a lot more money than Gibbs. And I know there are a lot of angry MAGA Trumpers out there who want to pay Meyer back for his impeachment votes. But I just think Meyer is going to pull it out. I could be wrong. And if Meyer does not win the nomination, I think it really sets the Democrats up well in November with Hillary Scolten as the nominee against John Gibbs.
Well, they're certainly spending a lot of money in West Michigan to try and make sure that happens. So we'll see if the Meyer name on grocery stores all over West Michigan help him out on that.
No, I just want to say that one thing that I did find really amusing with the John Gibbs campaign is that he has campaign graphics where he takes the Meyer storefront and he puts Gibbs on top of
it. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. I haven't seen that yet. That's great. Haley Stevens or Andy Levin in the 11th Congressional District?
Haley Stevens, in my opinion, is going to win this maybe fairly easily. Kind of an incredible story there with Levin actually insisting that he's running in his home district. It's where he's had his home. But the Democrats wanted him to run in the 10th, which he also could have, which he represented now. He's representing it today. But he chose to run in the 11th. And then this idea that you could have a Jewish member who is being pilloried and assaulted with millions of dollars of ads against him by the pro-Israel lobby, kind of an incredible story. And yet it makes sense because Levin has aligned himself with the Palestinian Bernie Sanders faction of the Democratic Party. And I don't think that's going to go well. against Haley Stevens in the primary.
Yeah, so I covered, so they brought Bernie Sanders to Pontiac on Friday night to kind of rally for Andy Levin, Rashida Tlaib, specifically Andy Levin, because of how hot that this race has gotten, the competition. And when I went to cover it, and I remember back in 2016, 2020, Bernie Sanders was attracting stadium filled audiences. And I get there and I'm like, where are all the Bernie kids? Where did they go?
The Bernie bros
were not there. I mean, they were. There was about like 500 people spread out in a social district setting where they had bars open. People were getting food. People were drinking craft beer with union advocacy signs next to them. But I went to ask people, and there was a lot of individuals that told me, like, yeah, I don't really know who Andy Levin is. I'm still doing my research, but I'm here for Bernie.
And some of them didn't even live in the district.
Yeah, there was a lot of people who lived in the 13th district with Sharif Anadar and Adam Hollier. There was a lot of people who lived in the Rochester area that were in that 10th district. And so there was a lot of people that were not even close to being in his district.
Well, you mentioned Adam Hollier, so let's go to the 13th congressional district. What do you think is going to happen there, Bill?
Which one now?
So this is the 13th congressional district. We got Sri Tanadar, Adam Hollier, Portia Roberson, Sherry Gay Dignago, John Conyers the third.
That's a tough one again. Actually, I think that could go any number of three or four ways. I'm going to go with Hollier, but I could be dead wrong. I think it's going to be very close. Tanadar obviously put a lot of his own money into it, $5 million at least, but all these PACs came in for Hollier, and Portia Roberson, it's amazing that she stayed as, you know, prominent in this race as she is, and Sherry Gay Dagnogo, she has a constituency. It's a tough one, but I'm going to go with Hollier.
All right, let's move on to the 8th State Senate District, where we have Mallory McMorrow against Marshall Bullock in the only race in the State Senate where we have incumbent members of the State Senate going up against each other.
I'm going to go with McMorrow. I just think the constituency, the demography of that district favors her. I think this is a symptomatic of the kind of thing that the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to be looking at after the November general election. Was the reapportionment plan drawn up by the Independent Citizens Commission for Congress and the State Senate and the State House basically racial gerrymandering? And is the African American community going to be decimated by the election results? I think they are. And I think the court's going to look at that. And they're going to say, we're going to make some people go back and do some redrawing of lines going into 2024.
There's a lot going in Mallory McMorrow's favor, isn't there, Samantha?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, when I went to cover that district, a unique thing I want to point out with the differences between these two candidates, Mallory McMorrow is in a position where she is fundraising directly to flip the Senate caucus to bring a Democratic majority, where it's something that she mentions as part of her campaign strategy. It's something, if you look her up on Twitter, she's saying, I have enough money, let's fund districts that are flippable. However, Marshall Bullock, on the other hand, when he talks to voters in this district, he's saying, do you know what happened because of redistricting and what's at risk here, which is the risk of representation. So it definitely is kind of different to see these two candidates, one who's, you know, essentially kind of celebrating this opportunity that Democrats have that they haven't had in decades. And on the other hand, it's about the real price of representation and what will be the long-term impacts of this forced marriage between the Oakland County honeypots and Detroit.
Yeah, and this is kind of representative of several other races across the Southeast Michigan region. We're going to move on to another one, though. This is the only race where we have two incumbent House members who are both on the ballot together running against each other. We've got Representative Andrew Beeler and Representative Gary Eisen. Who do you think wins this one, Bill?
I'm going with Beeler. I know Eisen actually won in kind of an upset in a primary just a couple of years ago. People didn't think he'd win necessarily. But I think Beeler is an up-and-comer. And, you know, it's again, going to be a tough, close race potentially, but I look for Beeler to pull it off.
The 17th the 17th State Senate District, where we have Kim Lasada, the state senator, running for another term against Jonathan Lindsay, who's been endorsed by Donald Trump.
Yeah, that is another surprise race nobody really saw coming. But Lindsay got in this race early before the final lines were set, and he refused to back down when he found himself in a district with an incumbent senator, Kim Lasada. This is a tough one, and Lindsay's got the Trump endorsement, right? But I'm going to go with Lasada. I think she's going to pull it off.
You know, a few, because I also covered on that primary, too. One thing interesting about Jonathan Lindsay, we covered a lot about, you know, individuals connecting with the Trump endorsements through the Maddox family. However, Jonathan Lindsay, he basically, how he described it to me, is that him and his wife sat down and they said, what are we going to do to give our campaign an extra edge? And they sought out a Trump endorsement on their own without the Maddox involved at all. And he didn't meet them until after he got the Trump endorsement.
How did he do that?
So his wife, Allison, her father was actually an economist within the Trump circle and also within the Ronald Reagan circle.
Wow. So he knew Trump that way.
I don't know if he did it directly through her, but I mean, his wife is heavily involved with that campaign. She's essentially allowed her living room to turn into what she described to me, Grand Central Station, with volunteers coming in and out. And but it's interesting because when you go to Bronson, when you go to the rural communities of this district, they don't even talk about the Trump endorsement. They talk, oh my gosh, my son went to school with him, or oh my gosh, like I grew up with the Lindsay family. His mother was a school bus driver. His father's a road commissioner. You know, he's someone who definitely has more than just the Trump endorsement, which I think makes him very interesting when it comes to these legislative Trump involved races.
Didn't he go to Yale?
And he went to Yale.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's put his Ivy League education to good use.
Spoken like a good Ivy Leaguer there, Bill.
Yeah.
Let's move to the first state Senate district here. Erica Geis, Frank Liberati, and there's also three Detroit candidates who are running in this one.
I think Erica Geis is going to pull this off, and it's kind of a tough thing for her to do given this new district, very different from what she had running against the Liberati, who, you know, between the two, Tullio and his brother have, you know, been in the legislature for nearly a decade. But I think she's going to pull it off.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. It seems that if there was just one Detroit candidate who is running an effective campaign, I think that Erica Geis could be in trouble, but we have three Detroiters, and none of them are really distinguishing themselves as far as being a strong campaigner. The Senate Democrats have really rallied behind Erica Geis to help her out in the Detroit area, knocking doors, helping her out. So I think that should be enough to get her over the top. Let's move on to the 88th State House District. This is Representative Greg Van Workum against Mick Bricker, Trump endorsed. And also his son is married to the Maddox's daughter. So who do you think wins this one?
This is almost like a mini version of the Meyer-Gibbs primary covering the same territory. I mean, where you've got, you know, the incumbent under siege from a conservative Trump-endorsed candidate in a Republican primary. And it's apparently a real barn burner over there. And Van Workum has spent a lot of money with ads and everything else. I predict Van Workum is going to pull it off, but I could be wrong. You know, these people like Lindsay and Bricker and some of these other challengers could do a heck of a lot better tomorrow than we think. And it'll be amazing. If they do, it'll just be another feather in the cap of Donald Trump, and it'll show that money and incumbency aren't necessarily a pathway to victory.
All right, we've only got time for one more. It's the 11th one, and this is the 35th State Senate District. This has got Representative Annette Glenn, Tim Kelly, former state representative, Christian Velasquez, and Martin Blank.
I'm going to go with Annette Glenn. I know it's tough. Three good candidates up there, three strong candidates. But I think Annette Glenn is going to win this nomination. And then it's going to be a heck of a race in November on the in the seat. Could determine control of the Senate.
And we'll talk to you about that. How about the Monday before the Tuesday election? We can talk about that and other races, Bill.
Hey, that's fine. I'm game unless I'm totally embarrassed with my calls today. You say, why do we want this guy back? He's wrong about everything.
Well, then they'll know. They'll know that you're wrong. So they'll just go ahead and just presume the opposite will happen.
Well, you can use me as a punching bag the day before the next election. Say, we brought on the guy who it's easy to make predictions against. You're going to win and he's going to be wrong.
We'll see how it goes. Well, thanks for the time again, Bill. We appreciate it. Take care, and we'll talk to you next time.
My pleasure, Kyle. Samantha, really great to be with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Joining us now for the podcast is the CEO of Strategic National. It is John Yob. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to be here, Kyle.
So what did you think on Friday at about 8 o'clock when you saw Donald Trump come out in favor of Tudor Dixon and get his endorsement?
Well, I was certainly not surprised. I mean, if you go back to that spring rally that he had, I think it became clear to all of us, both with sort of access to behind the scenes information and those just sort of watching at home on TV, that he had an affinity for her of some sort. And so I was not surprised at that point in time at all. And by the time Friday came around, I think most of us knew there was a few day period early in the week where it looked like it might not happen. But by the time he did that hint on Friday morning, I think it was clear to us what was going to happen on Friday night.
What do you think brought him over the edge? Was it the outside polling that showed that she was likely going to win, or what was it?
Frankly, I think he was sort of always there, and it was just a question of whether there was anything that was going to hold him back, rather than any given thing putting him over the edge. His grassroots supporters here across the state have been in a war with the establishment going back a year now, and they've certainly communicated that to him. So those candidates who have been running in precinct delegate races and those precinct by precinct battles and those county fights at the county conventions, at the district fights, all the way up to the state convention in April, and then continuing with these legislative fights that have been going on across the state have been communicating to him and saying, hey, you know, she's on the other side of us and we're in a war here. And are you really going to endorse the candidate who sort of represents the opposition of this battle that we're in the state?
I mean, it kind of goes to this post from Scott Greenlee on Facebook. I don't know if you saw this on Saturday.
But I didn't.
So Scott Greenlee, a political consultant on the Republican side, he wrote in part, for those who are the most hardcore Trump supporters and part of the current patriot wing of the GOP, does this make Trump himself a rhino, a never-Trumper, or an establishment hack?
Well, I usually agree with a lot of things Scott says, but that wouldn't be one of them.
Okay.
I look at it a little differently. The way I see it is much more like what played out in Pennsylvania. So in Pennsylvania, if you recall, Trump didn't endorse the candidate that was preferred by the grassroots of the party there either. He preferred, I forget her name, but the African-American female candidate. And obviously the grassroots did. And he obviously went with Oz. Oz pulled out a narrow victory. But it was a similar sort of situation where he went against those that are most loyal to him in the state. And, you know, I think that's where the term ultra MAGA was first coined. And I think now you're going to see that same thing here in Michigan, where there's a good portion of the grassroots across the state who don't necessarily are questioning whether Donald Trump is still their leader here today.
Well, I mean, that kind of brings me to my next question. Does this endorsement embody the end of the rhino hunting era that we've seen within the Republican Party? You know, now that we're seeing Donald Trump endorse candidates that were initially being targeted as rhinos, you know, is this a change in that movement?
No, I don't think so. I think what you're going to see is a opening for and a resurgence of what I would call the ultra MAGA movement. That is a movement that necessarily doesn't go along with President Trump when they don't agree with the decisions that he makes, which is the same thing that's played out in other states when similar sort of circumstances has occurred. So I don't think so at all. I mean, what we've had here in Michigan has never really happened before. I mean, you've literally had battles taking place for a year now. We moved up that state convention to an earlier point, and therefore these fights started a year earlier, or at least 6 months earlier than they ever have before. And so they've been fighting at the grassroots level, precinct by precinct. The mailings that have been going out, not just on the rhino hunting side, but also on the establishment side. I saw one mailing that said that one person was a crook because they know somebody who was a felon. So if everybody who knew somebody is a felon is automatically a crook, I think that's probably a step too far, especially in a primary audience. So, I mean, these wars have been pretty darn intense. And one endorsement by President Trump isn't going to negate everything that's happened over the last year.
Would you agree with the Steve Mitchell commentary on Friday that as far as the Republican primary, it is now game, set, match?
Absolutely. Yes. I'd say that the over under of the number of points she wins by is roughly 20, maybe 18. So I think she's going to win this. It's not so much that all these voters moved because of President Trump. I mean, she was already sort of getting, I would say, at least half of that benefit. Her campaign did a good job of putting that ad, or not her campaign, I guess, but the outside group supporting her campaign did a good job putting that ad on TV that had the nice things that President Trump said about her at that spring rally. And so if you're an average voter sitting at home who actually watches those channels, I think they already thought President Trump endorsed her. So I'm not sure that had quite the significance that folks assume the endorsement of itself. But what did have a huge significance is just the media frenzy around it, like trying to break through in that final weekend when you've got 30% undecided and all anybody wants to talk about is what you think about President Trump endorsing your opponent. It's pretty tough to break through that. It's a little bit like CNN saying, I don't understand why President Trump's leading in all these polls in 2016. Meanwhile, they air 100% of every rally that he holds. It's a bit ironic, but I think that the attention around the endorsement was really probably more important at that point in time than the endorsement itself.
And who do you imagine being the type of voters that are still sitting in this pool of undecided?
I think today, if you're undecided, you're not voting. So I don't know what the voter turnout will be. I think it's hard to predict given the lack of affinity that voters had for the field in general. Frankly, you know, a lot of voters, especially in Southeast Michigan, just assumed they'd be voting for Chief Craig. And so his numbers in Southeast Michigan were in the 40s or even 50s for a long, long time. And so a lot of voters down there just didn't really pay attention to the race because they just sort of assumed they'd be with him and therefore didn't really focus on it. So the large number of undecideds, I think a good portion of them probably won't vote. And then the others will probably go with Tudor Dixon.
What happened with Chief Craig? Because, I mean, you look at this, John, and a year ago, we all just kind of presumed it would be him here at this stage.
The beauty of Chief Craig as a potential nominee for governor is everything that has now failed to happen. So the beauty of it, the reason I was attracted to it, some in what you call the West Michigan establishment, whatever you want to coin that, were attracted to it. Governor Engler was attracted to it. Pretty much most people around the state were attracted to it was because it represented this unique opportunity to unite everybody together behind one candidate. And we could all sort of move forward with the candidate that all of us at that point in time viewed as the strongest candidate in a general election. And I think it maybe would have been had he run a good campaign or even a decent campaign. And so, it was a really attractive thing for a lot of us, especially those of us who have been in battles going back years. The notion that all of us would work together to try to elect Chief Craig was very attractive to a lot of people. But in my view, Chief Craig wasn't necessarily ready for that as a person. You know, I don't think he understood the level of commitment that took. You know, if just because somebody wants to support you and they live in Alpena, Michigan, and they're a key person, you got to drive up to Alpena, Michigan and talk to them and get to know them. Just because they want to support you doesn't mean they're automatically going to. So in my view, there was a lot of travel that was required outside of Southeast Michigan, even to meet with very, very important people, very high level people, very, very big donors. He just didn't want to meet with them. And so I think the party was ready for him. All the key players across the state was ready for him, but I'm not sure he was ready to be a nominee for governor.
I mean, this race is also going to be, I mean, heavily remembered for the signature fraud. What's still going on with that? And what are kind of some of the long-term repercussions or the game changers of experiencing such signature circulation fraud?
I think most people are waiting for the Attorney General to follow up. I mean, they acted very, very quickly. I give them credit for doing so when they raided the one gentleman's house over there in Macomb County. So I think most people are sort of waiting for them to follow up. In terms of making sure it doesn't happen again, you know, Perry put out a plan, and I hope it gets more attention than just sort of being a political plan, because I really think it would solve the problem. In my view, the Secretary of State should offer a service. They can charge for it, charge a lot of money for it, for all I care, but they should offer a service where if you have petitions, as you're collecting them, you can take in, say, 20 of them or 50 of them or 100 of them and have them do a check. Because right now we can't check signatures. And so we have no way of knowing whether somebody who we hired or a volunteer in the field or somebody, a Democrat up to no good or whatever else. I'm not saying that was the case here, but you never know what you're getting back, and you have no way of checking it against the voter file, meaning the signature of the voter file. You can check and see if they're a registered voter. You can sort of look at it and say, does this make sense or not? Does it look like a legit signature? But you can't actually match it up against the signature on the QVF. And in my view, if the Secretary of State would offer that service, that more than anything else would make sure it never happens again.
Do you think Perry Johnson got into the race too late? I mean, had he gotten in earlier, could he have maybe gotten more signatures, gotten maybe a better quality check on the signatures? Would it have made a difference?
I don't think he got in the race too late. I think, you know, looking back on it, if I have a regret, it's that we didn't run it up to 28,000 signatures. You know, we turned in a little over 23,000. That said, had we turned in 28,000, I'm not sure we would have gotten through anyway. Partially because the Secretary of State never analyzed our signatures signature by signature. Mm-hmm. So if we turn in 28,000 and they still refuse to analyze them signature by signature, then we probably still wouldn't have gotten through. But I certainly have regrets about not running it up to 28,000. But I'm not sure that that means that we would have been on the ballot.
When it comes to this pool of GOP gubernatorial candidates, which candidates do you imagine disappearing if they lose? And which candidates do you imagine still having a career and a future in Michigan politics?
You know, I think all of these candidates have a future in Michigan politics if they so choose. I don't necessarily think they ran for the right thing the first time. And so maybe they get down on themselves or upset, or it puts real strains on family and finances that we don't necessarily see out front what goes on in a household at home. And so in my view, a few of them probably should have run for lower level offices. And had they done that, probably would have a very, very bright future in the party and could have run for governor down the road. In terms of the order that they chose to go in, I think Saldano has been very, very impressive. I mean, he has built a grassroots network with no TV ads until a week ago or so that got him up to 12-14% in the polls. That's never happened in Michigan before that I'm aware of. No grassroots candidate. Hoekstra sort of did it in 2010, but he was already a congressman, so you can't really count that. And so of a candidate with no electoral history, no money, running a grassroots campaign, just traveling across the state and using social media, he built it up into double-digit support and raising what turned out to be, I guess, millions of dollars. So I would say what he did was very, very impressive. Ryan Kelly, very, very similar story. Didn't raise as much money, but very, very impressive on the stump. I mean, if you didn't know anything about the January 6th or anything else, and you just saw Ryan Kelly up there give a speech, he's a pretty impressive candidate. He does a pretty darn good job. Frankly, he's almost like an actor or something. I mean, I think he'd have a very, very bright future. So I think I don't know if Ralph is going to, you know, I doubt he runs for anything again. I don't know. I don't know Ralph all that well, but I would say Saldano and Kelly certainly have a bright future if they choose to do so.
Why did Kevin Rinke not have this thing cinched? He was the only person who was willing to bring significant resources to the table. Once Perry got kicked off the ballot, he had $10 million on TV. And you would think that would be more than enough to button this thing up. But he didn't. What was his failures?
Well, I would say a few things to that. One, it's not as easy to move numbers with straight TV ads as it used to be. What I said about Soldano being the first to do what he did from a grassroots perspective, the inverse is also true. If you go out there trying to just run TV ads, it is harder to move numbers. The one thing that does tend to move numbers is when you put Trump on TV, whether it's just praising him or as an endorsement. But other than that, it is hard to move numbers in primaries these days, whether you look at Ohio or Arizona or Pennsylvania or Michigan. It's more difficult because not as many people watch broadcast TV, those kinds of things. And more people pay attention on social media. What I would say is if you went back 5 days ago, he had a real chance. I mean, in my polling, I had him pulling even about 4 days ago now, five days ago now. There was a moment where he had a chance. Tudor was getting the momentum or had the momentum, I would say, 2 weeks ago. When that ad went on TV, that essentially looked like she had been endorsed by President Trump. Then when Rinke went negative on the establishment support, all that kind of stuff, it did bring her down and certainly stunted her growth, but then ultimately brought her down a little bit. And Rinke did gain at the same time. And so it got to a point where it was about to be a real race, in my opinion. But then when President Trump got involved, obviously it went a different direction. So, you know, had Trump not gotten involved, it would have been a coin flip, I think. I think Tudor maybe would have pulled it out because voters were already had the perception that he was supporting her, even though he hadn't formally endorsed. But it would have been a coin flip in a very tight race.
Does it play to Governor Whitmer's advantage if these grassroots voters don't back Tudor Dixon in a general election if she wins?
Absolutely. I mean, Tudor Dixon has a real problem, in my opinion. We're going to wake up Wednesday morning. We're going to have a nominee who is down big in the polls, probably 8 or more points. You have a war zone in the grassroots. You have time quickly running out, given our late primary with an August primary. And a fact that the people don't realize is so important is that we have a late primary, and that's why governors tend to get reelected in the state. It's just hard for a candidate to go from broke on August 2nd, no matter which party you are, to then running against an incumbent governor that's been banking all their dollars with only 6 to 8 weeks to go until ballots go out. So I think she's got a lot of real problems. The three most important, in my view, are party unity. Hopefully she does her best to bring the party together, to reach out to all the people who want to defeat Governor Whitmer but aren't exactly thrilled with the manner in which she won, or her candidacy, or her supporters for that matter, and try to unite the party in time for the state convention. Then you've got the money problem. She's not going to be able to compete with Whitmer for hard dollars. And many of the normal GOP big donors in Southeast Michigan are either sitting on the sidelines or supporting Whitmer because they like her, have gotten to know her, maybe agree with her on abortion or whatever else. So it really depends on how much money the West Michigan donor community spends in the general election. Are they going to spend $10 to $15 million to try to prop her up and make her competitive? Or are they going to spend $2, $3, $4, $5 million and try to give her enough support so that it doesn't dramatically hurt the down ticket, but sort of understand that it's a long shot to actually win? But again, time is running out. She's got to figure out a way to unite the party, get all these people who have been fighting for a year now at the precinct delegate level, at the legislative level, at the county convention level, at the district level, at the state convention level, and try to get them all to unite behind her and ultimately her choice for lieutenant governor in the next 3 weeks when we have a state convention.
It would seem that that is a very hard task. What would you put the odds of her being successful at? You give her a 20% chance, 10% chance?
Winning the general election?
Yes.
I would say 10 to 15%.
Okay. And what's got to happen? Does the economy got to go south? Is there external factors that have to take place here?
I mean, Michigan is a ticket-splitting state. And Michigan has sort of decided that although they don't necessarily like Joe Biden right now, they're still favorable towards Gretchen Whitmer. Last, I think, credible poll I saw had her job approval at about 55%. You're not going to beat a governor whose job approval is anywhere near 55%, especially in a Democrat-leaning state. The overall trend nationally, although theoretically was going to be strong for Republicans, I think, given what happened with Roe v. Wade, I think that advantage has dissipated, and that certainly has been shown in polling across the country. You know, we're now losing in Pennsylvania. We're now losing in Ohio, a state that is supposedly 7 to 10 points more Republican than Michigan these days. The fact that after the Trump endorsed candidates in Pennsylvania and the Trump endorsed candidates in Ohio came out of those primaries with a double digit deficit says a lot about what Tudor Dixon is about to face.
And what do you think the chances are that Republicans retain the Senate and the House, if you've even looked at that?
Well, I can speak for myself in that I'll be, once this primary is over, it may surprise you to hear, but once this primary is over, I'll be urging people to support Tudor Dixon, largely because we need to protect the Senate and the House and other seats. I don't think that she's going to be the next governor of Michigan. I'm not necessarily fond of her team. However, I do think it's important that Republicans do what they can to try to come together and unite and try to do as well as we can so that we can protect the House and the Senate. My view is that the House is probably in pretty good shape. I think the Senate is probably a little more precarious. And I think a lot of it has to do with how well the party is able to unite. You know, are we still fighting at these at the precinct level and at the legislative level when we come out of these primaries? If we are, then those candidates will probably have a problem. If we're able to put the pieces back together by the time of the state convention, then I think we probably hold the House and the Senate. And I think, interestingly, I think we probably win some education board seats, just because there's a difference between Michigan's a ticket splitting state and the education seats, as you know, Kyle, really are the better indicator of where sort of the party is at relative to each other, because those candidates tend to not have very, very good name ID. So I think that we'll see that even though Whitmer likely wins by a pretty decent margin, maybe a large margin, I think you'll see that the Republican point value, if you will, based on the education seats, probably still ends up favoring Republicans by a point or two.
All right, we got to let you go here, John. Last question here. John Gibbs against Congressman Peter Meyer. You're there in the West Michigan area. What do you see happening there?
I polled it 2 weeks ago, and I had Gibbs winning by 17 points. At that point in time, but I have never seen an onslaught like I've seen the last 2 weeks here. When I'm working, I'm in front of a TV here in Grand Rapids, and I usually have Channel 8 on, and the number of ads and the amount of money spent on ads is unlike anything I've ever seen. After the Dems put that $500,000 supporting Gibbs, Meyer responded, or his supporters responded, with some serious dough. So, and it was very negative stuff. So I don't think that Meyer will be able to overcome that 17-point deficit in the last 2 weeks, but he sure gave it a pretty good try.
John Yob, the CEO of Strategic National, appreciate you taking some time speaking with us. Thanks. Here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks, guys.
Now for the podcast is Senator Ken Horn. He is a Republican from Frankenmuth. Thanks for being on the podcast today, Senator.
Oh, thank you, Cal. Thanks, Sam.
Well, we wanted to have you on to talk about a book that you authored called Letters to Heaven, the story of a grandfather's loss, love, and rediscovered faith. And this has to do with a very tragic situation that happened in your life and the loss of your two-year-old granddaughter, Zelly. For the listeners who aren't familiar with the story, can you tell our listeners what happened?
Yeah, to start out with, Zelly was born in 2015, and I had a habit of writing to my grandson, and I wrote a letter to my granddaughter Zelly the day she was born, and then I just kept writing letters to her, and I started a little segment on Facebook, Chilling with Zelly, and people got to know her through my Facebook posts and through these letters. In 2017, I was speaking at the NAACP Freedom Dinner, never leave the house on a Sunday. After I ate, when I owned my restaurant, Sunday was my day for the with family and friends, and it was our time to spend together. So it was unusual for me to accept an invitation, anything other than a Boy Scout tribute at noon or firefighter pancake breakfast. But afternoons were about barbecues with the family and spending time. I just got done speaking my part, and we're back at the table with Veronica when we got our call that something happened at home. And when we pulled into the driveway, our corner lot was surrounded by fire trucks and ambulances and police cars, and lights were going. They were just setting up spotlights My son pulled a Zelly out of the pool, and it just happened so fast, and we don't know how she got back there through, you know, it was double gated, and we don't know how she got back there. She was so full of life and love, and it's part, that's how the story, it kind of takes you through. The grandfather's love is the kind of a little biography of, of how she impacted our lives and our neighbors, and tells you a story of our family, even our furry pets, and because they're all part of the story ultimately, and you'll read about them in the letters. Grandfather's loss is broken up into three sections. The grandfather's loss section, thankfully, is the shortest section. It was the hardest to write. And then the rediscovered faith was the letters themselves. And it took, and it took me a while, but when I started, started reading the letters again, I realized the first letter I wrote was directly to God. And then each one after that was to Zelly.
Now, and when you're talking about the letters, did you go back and reread the ones that you had done initially?
Yeah, in fact, it was the year after she had she left us. I spent my time, writing those letters. And this was the year of firsts, and people that, everybody's lost somebody. And it's the first Christmas, the first birthday, the first, grandparents' day, the first, Easter. And these are all very significant days. And there were just some days that didn't even require a holiday. There were just something that, that triggered a memory. And I just had to write. These letters would wake me up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and they just wouldn't go away till I put them down on paper. And so I wrote the letters, and people were messaging me and writing me how much it helped them in their losses. And then they started telling me stories about losses that they had that I never knew about. And people who have losses have a different way of communicating with each other, talking to each other. And then I let the letters sit for about a year. People were encouraging me to do something with that collection of letters, but I didn't have the courage to open up my Word document again. I would open it up, slam it shut. I just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And then one day it just dawned on me that I was forgetting her face and forgetting her voice. And it happens to all of us that, that are over time, when we lose somebody, that it just, you forget to what they look like, what they sound like. And so I made I was determined not to do that. So when I opened up the letters again, I started rereading. I started looking at old videos and just really just drove myself into it and just worked past all the hurt in the memories and the pain. And then once I started explaining what the letters were, the book then just kind of wrote itself.
So you started writing letters then shortly after her passing to kind of help you keep in communication, you felt like, with her? Or was this kind of more to help you with the pain?
Yeah, both. I mean, okay. It was cathartic. It was therapeutic. As I said, once the words started rattling around in my head, they just wouldn't go away. I had to put it down on paper. And the letters took 10 minutes to write, 15 minutes to write, because the words were just there. And it's the editing and the self-doubt, the, hitting the send button, because people were used to seeing the love that we had for each other expressed publicly. And to see this raw emotion, the moment that it happens, the press release that I wrote, Kyle and Sam, Jamie in my office, my chief of staff, mm-hmm. and Melanie Ryan, who was my communications director, they helped me write my press release, because I was just a blubbering mess at the time. And when you sit at your computer and you're just sobbing and rocking back and forth, it's hard to even see the keyboard. And so we walked it through. That was really a hard thing to do. But then I turned off all news, all TV, everything. It was just a blackout of everything that was happening around us. We were so focused on the family. And but the words just came into my head. And so when I wrote them down, it was the editing that, you know, making sure that, you know, I was saying the right things, that I was doing this for the right reasons. And I prayed over it. And so when I finally just hit the post button, the responses that we got from it were just extraordinary. And it just kept driving the next one and the next one. This morning I woke up, I just got a letter or a message from, from somebody I've never met, but it was a Facebook friend that said that their grandmother had died 10 years ago. And they just, she just finished my book at 1 o'clock this morning, and she just had to write me. Mm-hmm. It was a memory that, you know, because I talk about signs and, you know, and memories, you know, that come to us over the course of the loss immediately following, and to watch out for those little signs that, you know, that are sent to us, that everything's going to be okay, and the people that are sent to us, and that was what she took out of the book. And so everybody's going to grieve different. Everybody's going to see something different.
You know, how did navigating through this grief, how did that impact your career as a lawmaker?
It was interesting, Sam, because I write about it in the book, because when I first came back into my office, Mike Shirky had led, we had our original, we called him the freshman eight. Back then, this was in the previous term, and people, Marty Nolenberg was still there, Margaret O'Brien was still in office, and Dale Zorn, and we had, Wayne Schmidt, Mike led these folks in, and we just stood around, and they came in and bear hugs and talking about it, and it made it a little bit easier. It's always easier to talk about it. And when I hit the floor of the Senate, came into the chamber, people came up to me and they were expressing their condolences. And I write about them in the book too, but Mo Hood, Curtis Hertel, Jim Ananick, they never even said a word, not a word. They just came up and gave me the biggest bear hug. And they hung on to those hugs just a little bit longer. And then just walked away. Mm-hmm. Sometimes words just aren't necessary. Then there are some that, you know, you recognize that they don't know what to say, so they don't even make eye contact, and it's okay. Everybody handles it differently. This is a big, big loss, and they don't know what to say, so they just walk away. They step aside and they just give you your space. My tribute to Zelle in the order of statements was pretty long. I wasn't sure if I was going to make it through, but just told her story a little bit. It got that off my chest. But it was again Jamie that remarked that I was changed as a person. I didn't, all the petty politics, really. And you've heard me recently on the floor of the Senate talk about decorum and civility, and this is kind of where it comes from. That we shouldn't be yelling the petty politics. You set it all aside. There are more important things. I saw my colleagues more as friends than adversaries. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier to work with them when you do that. We don't have to get, we don't have to agree on every darn thing, but there's, we are human beings. And you've probably heard me at Invocation talk about heaven is real, really real. That's how I finished the book. I've learned some lessons through this whole process that have me convinced that this is very true. And so if we're all connected to heaven, then we're all connected to each other. It's our responsibility to know this and to treat each other, respectfully and with kindness. And so it changed me. And through this process, I sought out faith-based books and movies, to try to, to affirm and confirm what, the things I've been learning. And I watched the movie The Shack, and, there's one scene in the cave. It changed my opinion on capital punishment. I no longer favor it. It's not mine to judge. I don't judge people on their, on who they are, what they do in life. That's as long as they're not performing some criminal act, who am I to judge what, you know, how somebody else feels, what they think? That's for much higher power. And so this really did change me in office, and I explained some, a little bit of the transition in that book as well.
How many letters did you write to Zelli?
I don't know. I didn't really count them off. There's probably somewhere, I think 12 to 15 actual letters.
Okay. And you started off writing to God. Is that right?
Yeah, that was the first one. It was a very short one, and it was right in the middle of the raw pain, and it was more about thanking him, you know, for giving me Zelli, for even just the short time that we were together.
You didn't blame him.
I was angry. And I explained that the letter doesn't reflect the way I was feeling. I was bargaining with him.
Right.
You know, why her? Why not me? I'm over 60 years old. I was 58 at the time, but I've lived a pretty decent life. I can't complain. I'm grateful for everything I've had in my life. And here she is 2 years old with so much potential. I saw her growing up being just an athlete. She was a climber. She was a daredevil. And it was probably what got her into trouble. Yeah. But her 2 years here meant something, and I couldn't figure it out. And so my bargaining with God ended up being, you know, my first real foray into honest to goodness prayer. And I always thought I was a person of faith, but I realized how imperfect I was. And that's what I talk about with God, and I try to straighten that out with the letters after that, because the letters are to Zelli, but they really, even the letters that I wrote to my grandson Liam when he was in Ecuador, when he was just first born, were more, he's a baby. What does he know, right? So the letter is to him, but it's really talking over him, through him to his parents, you know, giving them lessons in life as well. Talking to other people. So when I'm talking to Zelli, I'm really talking to other people, my own family, my son, he's the dad. He's the one that, that pulled her out of the pool, that tried to save her. So he's got feelings of, of loss and guilt that he couldn't save his own daughter. And I have guilt because I wasn't there for her. I was going somewhere else. And so we all react differently. And part of that is, and any bereavement counselor can tell you, that everybody grieves differently. And one of the lessons is, don't let anybody change the way that you grieve. You do it in your own way, your own timeline. Don't let anybody tell you that you need to be strong for somebody else. This is a lesson that, you know, that people should learn. You take this time, and you don't forget, the pain doesn't go away. But the funny thing is, you don't want it to, because that means forgetting. You have a choice. You know, you're to face it head on and feel that pain. But that's one of the letters. It's titled, I Choose You, because the pain I can live with.
How did you know that now was the right time to get this book out there and to get it published?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I began to forget her face and her voice, and I couldn't do that. And once I started opening up the letters, I started explaining the letter. So the biography in the beginning of the book, the first section, leads you into understanding who she is and our relationship. And then the second is is how we lost her. And it takes you through a very private funeral. And then the letters, just again, all I had to do was explain my emotions, what I was thinking while I was writing it. And so the timing was set by, the fact that I just finally built up the courage to write it.
And the reception, can you talk about what kind of reception you've received? How long has it been out, and what have people been saying about it?
It started a week ago. Tuesday was the first time it hit a porch, from Amazon online, and it's still so fresh. Barnes and Noble doesn't even have the details to get it on a shelf, in an actual bookstore yet. So I'm still working on, you know, on getting some books for myself, you know, to take to, you know, to the libraries and donate them. That her favorite thing was the, you know, the Franklin Library. And so we've had a lot of people donate books to libraries in her name. And so I just think that donating my book for people that will be able to afford it is going to be a really important thing. And I've already had people that are buying the book and paying it forward. They're reading it, they're signing it, they're giving it to somebody else who's had a loss. And so they're buying multiple books to give to friends who have lost somebody. So it's really, I think it's really already taken on its, you know, we'll see. I don't know if, you know, writing the book and finally publishing is the end of a journey or a beginning of a new one. Maybe it's all part of one big one, but I don't know where what the Lord is going to direct me to do next on, you know, on this particular book, but so far it's gotten just an amazing response.
Well, that's great to hear. Well, thank you for sharing it with our listeners today. This is Senator Ken Horn, Letters to Heaven, the story of a grandfather's love, loss, and rediscovered faith. It is available on Amazon in hardcover and paperback. Appreciate you spending time with us today, Senator.
Thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Senator Horn.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Thanks to John Yobb and Bill Ballinger, and special thanks to Senator Ken Horn for jumping on earlier today. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. For Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.